This is Melissa, and it is the 10th day of May, 2026. I hope that you're all doing well. I wanted to share some comments about the second edition of the Cutting Through book. So I just want to read a couple of emails that I've received. Hi, Melissa. I received the CTTM book, and it is stunning. Your videos of the new edition were great, but one must have this book in hand to fully appreciate its true beauty. The feel of the book, the improved graphics, the feel and color of the pages, the lovely bio for Alan, and the photo chosen of Alan, all perfect. Well done, you and to those that helped with this Cutting Through edition. What a credit to Alan's books. This book will definitely be on display in my bookcase for everyone to notice and want to know about. And I just love to hear that. I do. Here's another one. The brand new Cutting Through book just arrived. Thank you so very much. You're absolutely right. It's simply gorgeous. I love the feel of it and the ease of flipping through it. I was able to instantly jump to the parts I was looking for from all three books easily without having to shuffle three books around. It's a fabulous edition that feels great in your hands. Clean, portable, easy to carry around. I love it. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Thank you again. So I also this morning got a call from Prince, and he was over the moon about his book. So it really does feel good to have accomplished this. I would love for you all to go and get one. And you can find out how to do that at cuttingthroughthematrix.com. And right there on the front page, you'll see a picture that Derek did of the front and back with the spine of the book. And you'll find out the cost of the book in your region, and that will include postage and airmail. So I'm going to just dive into a couple of things here. I think this is, I've got some things that I want to read besides emails for you. And so the Redux that I've chosen to go up today is one from 2009, May 7, 2009, and the title of it, I'll get back to the poem in just a little bit, but the title is Scientific Indoctrination for People Persuasion. And there are a few things newsworthy or that tie in with the topics that Alan is talking about, which of course is the new priesthood of scientists, the scientific dictatorship that we are under, that we've been under for a long time, the dehumanization that has, you know, the knocking man off his pedestal that Julian Huxley talked about the need to do, while of course they remain almost gods, which has been echoed by the likes of Yuval Noah Harari and Stuart Brand and others. You know, Stuart Brand said, we are as gods, so we might as well get good at it. And I linked to a documentary about him a couple of years ago. An interesting character. But this is the world that we live in, a scientific dictatorship, which I believe that we're under. I don't think we're going there. We are there. We have arrived. And it's because I think that we are already there. And what I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, what would Alan be talking about if he was still here? And I don't know. But I think that we are where he said we would be. And influences what I think about, what I spend my time doing, and where I put my attention. So a couple of things, though, that I will share with you are from Unshadowed. And I think his handle used to be, he's now on Substack, but a lot of you may know him as Ice Age Farmer. He's a Canadian named Christian. I don't know too much about him, but he's put out good information over the years. And I'm going to share a YouTube video that he put up a couple of days ago called The Tokenization Trap. You'll own nothing, they'll control everything. And here's a little description of it. Bezos, Vance, that's JD, the vice president, BlackRock, and the World Economic Forum are turning homes, cars, farms, and even nature into tiny fractional slices you'll own while they keep the asset and the control. With tokenized assets, your dividend only pays if you or the asset obey the technocrats' rules. ESG scores, carbon targets, compliance metrics, all will be enforced automatically. So, again, longtime listeners to Alan are going to know that he talked about these kinds of controls, the mechanics of how it works, not really that interesting to me. So I can't follow it slavishly because it's here. It will become more obvious that it is here and how it's here. This tokenization that Christian is talking about in this video, this is already here on the international scale for nations. And I've mentioned this before where, say, a country, I'll just pick Belize. I don't know if it's happening there or not, but it could, and it is happening in other places. Borrows money from the IMF or the World Bank or whoever, some big financial body. And all of this is tied to blockchain technology, which allows for tokenization, tokenized assets. And they are laid on a payment. And that triggers something which automatically goes into play. And they have whatever asset, if it was 10 miles of their beachfront, that is triggered. It automatically goes to the stakeholders, whoever has a stake in it in the bank, and that country, Belize, has lost 10 miles of beachfront. This is happening all the time, and it is going to start happening to us. And gas is going up. Wow, I mean, is this news? It's hardly news. This is from the LA Times, May 7. Gas prices are widening the wealth gap between wealthy and poor Americans. Lower income Americans sharply reduced their gas consumption in the month following the Iran war, yet spiking prices still forced them to spend more at the pump, worsening the economy's economic disparities. Higher income households, meanwhile, ratcheted up their spending on gas while barely reducing their consumption. Middle income households fell in between. And this is all kind of obvious that this is how people would behave given the steep price of gas. So I don't have a buffer between me and me. And I sometimes have joked that for the many years that I was with Alan, I was kind of a buffer between him and things that came in via email or mail, or, you know, he's set a time or two, things that have happened where, oh, you know, men in black and a, you know, with the windows shaded over car pull up, or there's something dropped down the chimney. But I think he said at one point in a talk, oh, yeah, well, people, you know, I don't get a lot of criticism, but people will say, well, you're sure a downer. You're awfully gloomy. Give us some hope. But the truth is, he got more than that from people. And for a long time, you know, I would say, oh, this email came in and this was sort of policy. Alan said, I don't want to hear about it. Is it a death threat? Or, you know, is someone going to, are they threatening to come to the house? And people did just show up from time to time. But, you know, otherwise, I don't want to know about it. Because the truth is, when people give you unsolicited criticisms, it is distracting. And I get a lot of that, and I don't have anyone to And I do, I must say this, I do hear from plenty of you who say that you appreciate what I'm doing and thank you very much. But, you know, if I talk to a neuroscientist who's an atheist, well, it looks like I'm going to hear about it. How dare you? Oh, this is like talking to a Nazi. And, you know, or if I talk to a theologian about the word spirit, I'm going to get an earful. You know, Alan, he was against all religion. And so I will get my inbox. I'll hear it. One of the ad hominem attacks is that I'm a woman, I'm female, and I have this, you know, because women, we like religion and spirituality. And I think there's probably some truth to that, you know. We know that Blavatsky came out to give us a blend of what became the New Age, what would appeal to women. And so that wasn't the mainstream, you know, the patriarchal man in the pulpit, but it was something that was just for women. So I'm not saying that, you know, that I can't handle criticism, but I am a woman. And so the way that I deliver things is going to, I guess, sound like that or feel like that. There's a song from My Fair Lady entitled, "Why Can't a Woman Be More Like a Man?" And this is the musical that was based on Bernard Shaw or George Bernard Shaw's play Pygmalion. And Pygmalion was in Greek mythology. He was a sculptor and he fell in love with one of his sculptures. And essentially that's the story that Bernard Shaw gave us, where Henry Higgins falls in love with the flower vendor, you know, on the street who's just, you know, she speaks like someone of her class. And on a wager, on a bet, he's going to turn her into a lady. And it has a lot to do with language. But remember, George Bernard Shaw was a Fabian. That's do it, you know, socialism real slow, but slow and steady. And he was the one who famously said that people would have to come to the elite, you know, the scientific elite, and justify why they should be allowed to live. And that's kind of where we are, really, where we are. Can I afford to put gas in my car? Can I afford to eat, etc.? So the triangle, the right triangle, the base of that is the feminine. We're the base. Evidently, we're in matter. We're mother, matter, earth. We're earthy. Why can't a woman be more like a man? I don't know. Maybe I'm not the right one to ask. So I was doing a little reading, and it may or may not tie in with this talk, but I kind of think it does in here. So I give you a glimpse, perhaps, into my thinking, because if I think this ties in, then you'll have to figure out why I think that. This is Morals and Dogma, Albert Pike. And he's talking about the mysteries and initiation into the mysteries. And the scientific and religious absolute and everything that led to the need to create the absolute. The Hermetic science of the early Christian ages, cultivated also by Geber, Alfarabius, and others of the Arabs, studied by the chiefs of the Templars and embodied in certain symbols of the higher degrees of Freemasonry, may be accurately defined as the Kabbalah in active realization, or the magic of works. It has three analogous degrees: religious, philosophical, and physical realization. Its religious realization is the durable foundation of the true empire and the true priesthood that rule in the realm of human intellect. Okay, so you get what he's saying there. There are priests who rule in the realm of human intellect. That means shaping what we're allowed to talk about. Its philosophical realization is the establishment of an absolute doctrine, known in all times as the Holy Doctrine, and of which Plutarch in the treatise, De Iside et Osiride, speaks at large but mysteriously, and of a hierarchical institution to secure the uninterrupted succession of adepts among the initiates. Its physical realization is the discovery and application in the microcosm or little world of the creative law that incessantly peoples the great universe, as above, so below. Measure a corner of the creation. Okay, now we've got the tools of measurement. And multiply that space in proportional progression, and the entire infinite will multiply its circles filled with universes, which will pass in proportional segments between the ideal and elongating branches of your compass. Now suppose that from any point whatever of the infinite above you, a hand holds another compass, or a square. The lines of the celestial triangle will necessarily meet those of the compass of science to form the mysterious Star of Solomon. So now we visualize the two intersecting triangles. All hypotheses scientifically probable are the last gleams of the twilight of knowledge or its last shadows. Faith begins where reason sinks exhausted. Beyond the human reason is the divine reason. To our feebleness, the great absurdity, the infinite absurd, which confounds us and which we believe. For the master, the compass of faith, is above the square of reason. But both rest upon the holy scriptures and combine to form the blazing star of truth. Okay, so then the Star of Solomon might all, you know, that's the blazing star of truth. As above, so below. The bottom is open and receiving, the female principle. And the top is pointing down to the open, the male, the masculine principle. And it goes on and on with Kabbalistic doctrine and magic. It's interesting. But right there, it said that the absolute doctrine of which Plutarch wrote about. So I'm going to share a little bit about Plutarch from a different book. And the book is The Illustrated Golden Bough by Sir James George Frazer, A Study in Magic and Religion. This is from Chapter 8. The transference of evil. The notion that we can transfer our guilt and sufferings to some other being who will bear them for us is familiar to the savage mind. It arises from a very obvious confusion between the physical and the mental, between the material and the immaterial. Okay, so he sets it up, and then he goes into a very interesting chapter on the transference of evil and the scapegoat, transferring evil to something else. Now, Sir James George Frazer, he was one of the founders of modern social anthropology, born in Scotland, graduated Cambridge, etc. He was fascinated by the history of human belief, and he wrote articles on totemism and taboo. And this became published in 1890. The Golden Bough. But here I am on to human scapegoats, because there are all kinds of sacrifices and scapegoats. The ancient Greeks were also familiar with the use of a human scapegoat. In Plutarch's native town of Charone, a ceremony of this kind was performed by the chief magistrate of the town hall and by each householder at his own home. It was called the expulsion of hunger. A slave was beaten with rods of the Agnus Castus and turned out of doors with the words, "Out with hunger, and in with wealth and health." When Plutarch held the office of chief magistrate of his native town, he performed this ceremony at the town hall, and he has recorded the discussion to which the custom afterwards gave rise. But in civilized Greece, the custom of the scapegoat took darker forms than the innocent rite over which the amiable and pious Plutarch presided. Whenever Marseille, one of the busiest and most brilliant of Greek colonies, was ravaged by a plague, a man of the poorer classes used to offer himself as a scapegoat. For a whole year he was maintained at the public expense, being fed on choice and pure food. At the expiry of the year, he was dressed in sacred garments, decked with holy branches, and led through the whole city, while prayers were uttered that all the evils of the people might fall on his head. He was then cast out of the city or stoned to death by the people outside the walls. The Athenians regularly maintained a number of degraded and useless beings at the public expense, and when any calamity, such as plague, drought, or famine, befell the city, they sacrificed two or three of these outcast scapegoats. One of the victims was sacrificed for the men, and the other for the women. And it goes on to talk about the scapegoat. I could read more. I found some interesting section there on Manly P. Hall and what he had to say about the scapegoat. But the point that I'm trying to make is that in the idea, I like Fraser's idea of the transference of evil, we need to have someone to blame. And that's why we look outside and we say, them, over there, them with their weird customs, the things they do, we don't like them. They're bad, they're not like us, and we want to get rid of them. I think that's what we see on the internet. There's lots and lots of scapegoating and finger-pointing, and people say, you know, they're the cause of all the problems. And of course, the obvious one is the juice, you know? That's ancient forever. It's the forever thing. And you could never talk about that. I mean, Alan used to say in Canada, where you couldn't talk about it, nothing should be off limits. We should be able to talk about everything. We should be able to talk about everything. Like a child. Why? What is this about? What's going on here? But we can't. We never have been able to. And the reasons are not so cut and dried as to what, you know, what we're supposed to see when we are looking at the scapegoat. So there's a big thing, you know, right now, a lot of people are just so excited about the latest sensation and predictive history, you know. Yeah, game theory and the poly market where you bet on everything and it's, ooh, wow, this is amazing that, you know, they got it right about Israel and U.S. going to war with Iran. Well, really? Really, that's like some kind of prophecy. That's an amazing prediction that we're all supposed to be impressed with. I mean, Alan told us in 2004 from the words of people like Zbigniew Brzezinski and Wesley Clark, you know, and reading the PNAC documents, this was on the books. And they've been softening it and setting it up since forever. But now this is all tied into some, you know, wonderfully imaginative thing called Pax Judaica. It's got all this religious stuff mixed in there, you know, Gog and Magog, and it's exciting. And it's good to have the transference of evil, right? Because you don't have to look at yourself. You don't have to look at your part in what you're doing in it. Frankly, I don't see any difference whatsoever in cycles of history that repeat themselves and waiting for the big cataclysm to happen as to wait for, you know, salvation with, you know, the clouds opening up and the hosts of angels. I don't see a difference. Whatever gives you the out, right? Well, I don't have to do anything. I don't have to do anything in my lifetime because, it's prophesied by whomever for whatever. Or see, I've been studying cycles. Millions of years ago, this happened, and it happened. It'll happen. Oh, okay, all right. So now I'm not impressed by it, and it's fascinating to me that people will scour the internet for the latest and greatest and most amazing, but they don't want to crack a dusty old book. No. Well, what happens then is you will fall into one conspiracy theory after another, one far-out idea, and, you know, it's what Alan said, stuff that's there for itchy ears. This article I'm going to put up, I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's Alan McLeod, and it was written for Mint Press in 2022. Meet the ex-CIA agents deciding Facebook's content policy. This is a very interesting article that I hope that you will read, because it talks about how many people that were affiliated with the CIA as agents and analysts have been put out into the workforce as product policy managers or manager for misinformation at Meta, or, you know, whatever the job title is. Now, does that mean that they're not sincere people who are trying to do a good job? I don't know. But, you know, we can figure it out together, or you can decide for yourselves. But if it's online, see, not only are we looking at something that is the instrument of total control and total surveillance, and as the now unshadowed Ice Age farmer says, you know, something that is the tokenization trap. And of course, everything that we put online makes this easier and easier to do. So I'm not keen on scapegoating. I'm not keen on putting everything on the juice or the latest sensation who, you know, has a new way to predict the future. No, thank you. Because I think it's there in Alan's talks for people who have the patience to go through them, for people who can stick with it. They can get the long view of history. And I'm going to bring up Sean Ross, who has a different idea about how far back things go. I think Alan took it back further. I'm satisfied with Alan's research and how far back he went. But people who've looked deeply at history, and I'm bringing up Sean Ross that I did a real history with a couple of years ago, don't land and stick on the juice, or as he liked to call them, the jaywalkers. It's you know, you're in the world of scapegoat. This is what Alan said in the Cutting Through books about the hermaphrodite. Very interesting section here. He says there's a picture. The above picture is from Albert Mackay's History of Freemasonry. He omits the written description. The queen is the completion of the great work. It is only a matter of time. Both Mackay and Pike say that the square below the compass represents the female. They say she is base material. Man is the active material. The proper name for the square is trisquare, tri being a term for refining metals. Woman is matter, mother, mare, the ocean. Masons repeatedly stress the perfection of number one. Adam's fall was in separating Eve from himself, so they claim. So what you get in the deviant priesthood class is a rejection of women, the base material. The hermaphrodite is the completion of the great work, is all in one. Neither male nor female, the hermaphrodite. Where in nature, what we see is male and female. So a lot of times people will point to the lineage of rationality and reason, and they point to the Greeks. They love to point to the Greeks. Well, I just told you about Plutarch, right? So at the time of Plutarch, you've got people who are sacrificing slaves to ward off famine or pestilence or whatever, the scapegoat, the transference of evil. So, yeah, I do. I think it's okay for me to talk to anybody about anything because I am interested in how people think and what they think. The world would be pretty bleak if everybody thought like me or you. But that's what Karens and control freaks want. Everybody should think the same. Point being about the Greeks, I mean, if this is the so-called patriarchal male lineage, if it descends from people who were sending slaves out to be scapegoats, and this is the masculine principle that's coming down through time in the rational and the reasonable, isn't it time that we try a different approach? It's been coming up a lot, both in Waiting for the Miracle Book Club and also now in Jung's The Undiscovered Self. Ian McGilchrist's work of the left and right hemisphere keeps coming up as a topic of conversation. And today I mentioned I had done a real history a couple of years ago with Peter, and it was entitled, there were two parts to it actually, and I'll link to them here, Left Brain, Right Brain, Peter Joins a Cult. And this was about the time that he spent doing a Vipassana meditation at a Vipassana retreat, which interestingly, Yuval Noah Harari says that he has to do this, you know, once a year. And Peter was talking about how it's concentrating on maximum serotonin release. And so people love it. They stay and they want to do it forever. But the conversation that we had today about the difference between what's happening in the left and the right hemispheres, but we were talking about the important, less talked about corpus callosum that mediates, if you will, between the two. And this comes up in this talk from Alan Watt. A caller called in. He asked Alan if he knew Roger Wolcott Sperry. And Alan said, yes, him and others. Well, Sperry was a neuropsychologist, neurobiologist, cognitive neuroscientist who lived in the first half of the century, of last century, and died in the mid-90s. And his area of, he was psychology, but he was very interested in and won a Nobel Prize for research with split brain patients, left and right, connected by the middle part. I've just gone through that. In split brain patients, the corpus callosum has been severed due to the patient's suffering from epilepsy, a disease that causes intense and persistent seizures. Seizures begin in one hemisphere and continue into the other. Cutting the corpus callosum prevents the seizures from moving from one hemisphere to the other, which then prevents the seizures from occurring. And it allows the patients to function normally instead of suffering from continuous seizures. So it's this work here and the questions that that work raised. One learns with one eye how to solve a problem. Then with that eye covered using the other eye, one already knows how to solve the problem. Sperry asked the question, how can the learning with one eye appear with the use of the other? So it's kind of grisly what scientists do, cutting eyes out of cats and so forth, and I don't like it. But nonetheless, interesting things have been studied. When I talk about spirit, Peter talks about left and right brain and how that works. So what I'm saying is There should be nothing that's off limits. There should be nothing that we're not allowed to have a conversation about if we are truly curious, because individuals get to be curious. It's the mass who wants to hold you into the mass with them. It's the, you know, so-called controllers who want to keep you as part of the mass because I guess you're easier to control there. There's a little bit more I'll just mention here in Morals and Dogma, where Pike is writing from the Idra Sutta, which is one of the foundation texts of the Kabbalah. And it says, God formed all things in the form of male and female, since otherwise the continuance of things was impossible. And it goes on to talk about wisdom being the father, intelligence the mother, the equilibrium between the two. What I'm saying is that you can call this whatever you want to. We can talk from a perichoretic or trinity point of view about what we're seeing in a relationship. We can talk about the left and the right brain. We can talk about the mystery schools and things that the initiates were taught. But we are going in one direction, which is removing from nature a true male and female principle and how they may work together and how we may see that in a brain or in a relationship. Or we can accept what has been designed in this great work, which is a deviant product. And I am of the mind that what is devoid of emotion, which is often associated with the female, and is only reason and rational, is incomplete. And I be a woman, so I am defending my right to be a woman and to have emotions and to draw from those. So speaking of the CIA, Ingo Swann is a really interesting character. If you've not heard of him, check him out. And he did a little bit of work with government agencies and the CIA in their interest in psi, you know, parapsychology, controlled laboratory experiments. But he is an interesting, I was sent this book as a gift. Why do we feel there is more to us than we or anyone knows about? A collection of Ingo Swann's Superpowers of the Human Biomind essays. And it goes on to talk about people who are gifted or ungifted or dormant with these abilities. And then he's talking about the degrees of gifts or abilities. To this degree, awareness, perception, and information are closely intertwined, so much so that if one is removed, the other two also disappear. This interconnected trio forms a complex, awareness, perception, and information. The interconnected trio forms a complex system that is vital to our understanding of the world. While most people have a general understanding of what a system is, many do not realize that an individual's biomind is made up of various systems that work together to create their existence. Therefore, it is possible to consider that awareness, perception, and information intake and output are all part of specialized systems within the larger system of the human biomind. But it does not stop there. In conventional terms, deducing is often not seen as a superpower. While it can be triggered by physical stimuli, it is largely a product of the mind rather than the five senses. Specifically, it is the result of ratiocination, a process of exact thinking and reasoning. It is important to note, however, that this term comes from Latin, ratiocinatus, meaning to reckon. The word reckon has a variety of imprecise definitions: counting, estimating, computing, calculating, considering, watching, and judging. Reckoning can involve determining something from a fixed basis, or it can occur without any clear basis at all, leaving us baffled as to how it works. In these cases, we turn to the notion of ken, K-E-N. Now, I just want to say here that I'd never heard of the word ken until I met Alan, and I don't know if this is a Scottish thing or not, but he would say in Scottish way of speaking, I dinna ken, if I asked him something, where is something, I dinna ken, I do not know. In these cases, we turn to the notion of ken, which refers to the range of vision beyond just what our eyes can see. It encompasses perception, understanding, and knowledge beyond the physical world. Ken is a word deeply rooted in the Old Norse language, where it holds various meanings and connotations. One of its core definitions, when translated into English, is a combination of perceiving, knowing, and recognizing, with a special emphasis on the latter. Exploring further into the intricacies of Old Norse reveals that kenning was not just a simple term, but rather a concept denoting the inherent ability to attain direct knowledge or understanding without relying on rational thought or interference. This distinction sets it apart from the more limited definitions found in English translations. Kenning embodies a profoundly deeper level of comprehension, one that transcends entrenched logic and embraces intuitive understanding. This, of course, is our present understanding of intuition, a mysterious process that defies rational thought or logical inferences. Now, to close here, I will read you the poem. Scientific indoctrination for people persuasion. Century of change, new civilization, well into the process of dehumanization. An essential element we must accept for the herd mentality, politically correct. Poor lost animals gorging trivia, mulling. Agreeing with experts, solution, the culling. Daily media updates, ideas shifting, people parrot the press, need little convincing, no comparative memory, original thought, nor knowledge how once freedom was bought. Happy species, soon to be extinct, oblivious, they're falling over the brink. Tell them why, they'll all sing. Depopulation's a very good thing. So, I said that was closing, but there's one more thing here. When a caller called in and he mentioned, I said, Roger Sperry and the research he's done on the left and the right side of the brain, and they went with that. So this caller is musing, how does this happen? Why does this happen? And Alan said, yeah, it's all practical to them and quite logical, that they would eliminate emotions. And the caller said, you mentioned earlier about how they admired fetuses as art or the anatomy in plastic. They see it as an art form, whereas a right-brained person who sees beauty in an artist would not see that the same way. And Alan said, that's right, it is. You must remember, these characters brought in what they called the Age of Reason. And they wrote screeds and screeds of stuff about how reason would rule. And the reason they claimed that the world was always in a mess was because people's emotions ruled their lives for them. Well, you see, we are complete human beings with emotion. If we don't have emotion, we're not a complete human being. We're a robot. Basically, we're robots. And these characters at the top, being psychopaths, of course, always look for a practical solution to them to suit their agenda, not humanity's agenda. They see themselves as farmers. And if we're superfluous in a certain area, well, you just cull off the excess herd. That's what you do if you're a farmer. And literally, that's what they want to bring in. They want to reduce the world's population down to 500 million people, and they've stated it over and over. And, they can blast down the Georgia Guidestones, but they still have the same idea here. And so the caller said, okay, that's basically what I wanted to bring up. And Alan closes by saying, yes, you're quite right, though. It's been a very old, ancient system of battle. And in early times, even the early Christian symbols would show Jesus ascending on the cross with a serpent wrapped around him. If it was just him, himself, it would be emotion. The serpent was wisdom and logic, so the two were combined, and that meant perfection. That was the early mystic symbol of it. If you just have pure, the serpent, you've got the cold, unemotional reason, that's hell on earth. So I think we've got hell on earth. I think I just shared recently that I think one possible, use of the cross as a symbol is that if you tell the truth in this day and age online in a public forum, you're going to be crucified on social media or whatever, where anyone has an opportunity to, they will crucify you. But I like Alan saying, you've got the female principle of emotion and the male principle of wisdom and logic, and perfection is only when the two of them are combined. So that is it from me. Again, I encourage you to go to cuttingthroughthematrix.com. and look up how to order the new second edition of the Cutting Through volumes, because they are as beautiful as I said they were. Take care.
There's a cold silence that we don't dare speak. There's a wall between us and a river so deep. We keep pretending that there's nothing wrong. There's a code of silence and it can't go on.
I'm Alan Watts, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 7th of May 2009. I always advise the newcomers, and there's always people coming in for the first time to listen to the show, to go into cuttingthroughthematrix.com website, where you'll find hundreds and hundreds of hours of talks that I've given in the past, where I try to give you the shortcuts to understanding the big picture of the system, and is one system that runs and guides the world, how it's done, the various agencies it uses and the foundations behind it, how it's funded, etc., and where they want to take the whole planet, because those at the top really believe in Darwin and his theories of evolution. And they came to the conclusion, even before Darwin, in fact, Darwin was one of their front men, that they were the most evolved of their type. And they deserved to rule the world and decide what lived, what didn't live, what was useful to the economic system and what wasn't. And that's why everything's coming together in this 21st century, the century of change, as they call it. Taught all through academia, and it's only the general public who are ignorant of what's really happening. They think it's all this terrorism and crisis and flu pandemics and stuff like that. But it's nothing of the kind. You're simply going through a planned agenda. Also look into Alan Watts Sentient Sentinel for transcripts of these talks which I give, which you can download and print up and pass around to your friends. Those who like what they're hearing and it makes sense to them, and they can check it out for themselves. Because I try not to surmise about things. I try to use the documentation put out by the big boys themselves. Then they can support me by going to cuttingthroughthematrix.com website and buying the books and discs I have for sale. I'd have a lot more out there if it wasn't for the fact I'm too busy doing this program and so on. Or you can donate through personal check from the US and Canada. And it's on the website, as I say, cuttingthroughthematrix.com website tells you how to do that. And those who get the disc pass around, and lots of people do because they don't want computers, I don't blame them. The computer is the method of bringing the world into this one system, and it's going to be used for control. us for everything, for purchasing, for everything, as we go electronic. So those people can actually write to me. As I say, you have to help me to keep going, because it is expensive doing what I'm doing. And I don't ask any of the programs and shows I go on for money. That way I'm independent. I can say pretty well what I want to. I'm not hamstrung by people sponsoring me, basically. Those adverts that you hear on this show go to paying for the show, for the airtime. It pays for the station. It pays for the equipment. It pays for the engineers and so on. And I don't deal with that at all. So going back to this big, lovely world order we're going into, and most of the people on the planet are oblivious of it. They vaguely notice there's changes going on. They vaguely know it's something to do with terrorism and it's pandemics and there's pigs flying around in the sky or something, as pigs might fly. Because anything's possible these days, isn't it? Especially when your perceptions are given to you by the experts and they know how to make you believe anything. And most people do. In fact, it's too tedious for most people to even try and figure out what's really happening outside their own personal lives, their own little circles. They've been trained to leave it to the experts, trained over quite a few generations on purpose by those who understand the science of the mind. Back with more after these messages. I'm Alan Watt, and we're cutting through the matrix, discussing the fact that we're going through the major changes that I think Rockefeller himself said that we're going through the biggest upheaval, social upheaval, and migratory upheaval too, that has happened since really just before, or at the beginning, I should say, at least, of the industrial era, where millions of people were churned off the land and put into the big cities because the Rothschilds of the day had passed a bill in Europe and Britain, especially, but had their friends and their cousins elsewhere and their brothers doing the same thing in every country to get to the peasants to have stopped growing their own food and grains and so on. And the corn laws were passed, they're repealed, which enabled all foreign countries to dump the cheapest stuff in your country and put you out of business. Therefore, they all moved into the big cities, into these massive, massive slums, and were cramped together. That was an ideal situation for those who owned the big factories, and it was all planned that way. Because people don't like moving off the land. That's traditional. You get attached to the land, especially through generations of living on it. And you feel you belong, and that's what people have out of their lives today. They have no feeling of belonging. Everything's changing. Shops go up the last 2 or 3 years and then knock them down again. There's nothing to compare the past to. And that's intentional as well, because you're being upgraded every year or so into the new. This is the time that H.G. Wells talked about in his Shape of Things to Come, where the public would protest the massive changes happening with great rapidity, and they would not be given a breathing space. Rockefeller himself, as I say, a man who owns a foundation, the family foundation that funds 1,000 points of light, meaning NGOs and other foundations. Many of the foundations out there are simply fronts for the money to get passed through to throw you off the scent of who's behind it. And they all have the specialized parts to play as non-governmental organization, but mainly in population reduction, what they call family planning, and so on across the world and at home. Rockefeller said at a World Bank meeting a few years back, he said, this new world order will not be liked by people. He said, but we have to bring it in. He said, there'll be great disruptions. And he says, this generation alive now, he said, are unfortunate. They will be the cannon fodder. The cannon fodder. Those are his words for the agenda. So if you think that 2001, 9/11 was just a happenstance thing to kick off the 21st century, think again. You see, the velvet gloves are off the iron fist, and we're seeing force used and law after law rammed down people's throats across the planet. Same laws at the same time. They're not messing around now. They're not coercing us and mollycoddling us. They're not even bothering giving us great political speeches or anything like that. They're just ramming them all through. Because we've been trained, as I say, to simply obey now. We're into the obeyance stage of this. Now, the internet was put up initially and owned by the military-industrial complex, who still own it, by the way, if you think all these companies are separate and independent. And even the makers of your computers, they're all part of the military-industrial complex, because in their own writings, screeds and screeds of writings, they said that whoever controls all technology and science will rule the world. That was also the basis for the Cold War. They didn't give that up over and hand it over to free enterprise, because someone would obviously go off in their own direction and devise a system that they couldn't get into and really give the public some freedom. That was never the intention. The intention was to get everyone hooked in to this emerging system, where it's indispensable for everybody, businesses, individuals, right down, as I say, to your personal banking and purchasing, because that's how it will all be done in the future. Also paying your rents in the Agenda 21 little manifesto, because there'll be no private property. There will be no rent in the future. We've already seen government stepping in and taking over mortgages during this last manufactured crash. We have this strange public-private relationship once more, and houses that were once partially owned by people trying to pay off the mortgages are now owned and rented out by government. Same thing's happening in Britain and elsewhere. Whatever happens in Britain happens across the planet. And a few years ago, one of the first big internet censorship meetings was held in Canada for the United Nations. And they talked about how they'd use hate laws initially as the excuse to bring in censorship. But in the meantime, they let everybody play and say their thing, and everybody could let off steam and come from their various angles of reality and put things out. But then they would start to rope them in, you see. Because first you had to become dependent on the system, which is essential to run a world. It's not for our benefit, as I say. And Australia, of all places, has been one of the leaders in putting in these implementations that were at first suggested in the first meeting, and then unleashed into the further depth of censorship in their next meeting and so on and so on. And I read an article about a month or so ago where Australia was going after certain websites with certain terms and words in them. But now they're going a step further. And this is from the Register, the 7th of May. The Australian government yesterday broke new records for web censorship by requiring the takedown not just of a page containing harmful content, nor even a page linking to harmful content, but a page linking to a link, allegedly, of harmful content. The content of the Australian Communications and Media Authority, see, we've all got these coming into view, they're all set up, originally deemed to be inappropriate, was found on a US site. Now listen to what it was. Remember, there's only one system. See, the one system that's coming in now, remember, is a collectivist, Sovietized system to rule the people with massive bureaucracies and agencies and force. And everything that the so-called communistic side or left-wingers or the Council on Foreign Relations, who are often mistaken for the communists, in fact, they hid behind them, since they ran them, actually. They had a lot of protests when the old system of individual freedom and rights was still working. And once the left, gradually through the Fabian system, took over governments from within, that's what they call the legal way, they altered everything into a communistic system. And therefore, everything that's politically correct is part of the old Sovietized communist system. You understand that political correctness is communism. So this site where the inappropriate data was, listen to this, was Abortion TV on the US, a US site. It says the site is political in nature, clearly coming down on the anti-abortion side of that debate. and the page in question features pictures of aborted fetuses. Before the communists took over, you see, it would be the other side who were trying to stop the abortion issue, because they knew where it was going to go. It was going to go to forced abortion, and then eventually to sterilization, because they knew who was in charge of these programs, like Margaret Sanger, who loved Hitler. She admired his eugenics program. Now she's a saint. A saint in governments. Now you can go into art galleries and you'll see fetuses in jars of urine. They show it on television once in a while, this kind of stuff. But that's okay, because that's dehumanizing the human and the offspring of the human. It's anti-human. That's okay. That's politically correct. Because under the Earth Charter, you see, we're not an endangered species. Therefore, there's only one agenda and one side to it. And you have a generation who have grown up thinking this is the normal side. This is a normal thing. Because it exists already when they were born. And they have no idea, really, what its true program is or what it's all about. Remember going back, and I've read the articles, well, actually I read the book from Julian Huxley, who worked for UNESCO, the United Nations, who said, we must somehow devaluate humanity and get the public to accept it. Well, these guys don't just come up with ideas and sit and hope or send letters off to Santa Claus up the chimney. They implement them. And we hear these little implementation deals all the time, little blurbs amongst the mass of noise in this ether world that we live in. And we somehow think that none of it concerns us. If it does concern us, there's a specialist in my area who's obviously dealing with it for me. That's how people think today. Everything that happens in eugenics and depopulation concerns you. And you better wisen up to that very quickly. These guys are not messing around. They have been bioengineering the public. They have altered your food supply. They know what's in it. Once in a while, they'll admit the effects of it. Once in a while. The sterility in the Western world have gone through their own data. It's incredible. It's not a crisis because it's planned. 85% sterility in the male should be a crisis, but it's no crisis because it's planned. Otherwise, it would be, right? Obvious. I'll be back with more on this topic after this break. I'm Alan Watts, and we're cutting through the matrix. Just going through the fact that emotive topics are given to people, and a whole generation have been brought up, really, thinking it was about people's rights. And everyone likes to be the victim, especially when it's been drummed into you in school that you were. And it was nothing to do with that at all for those who organize it. They love to use our emotions to separate and conquer, divide and conquer. Always for a different motive. And the motive was published in the 1800s with various eugenicists in the American Eugenics Society right through the early 1900s, right in fact through the 1930s. The real agenda. And the real agenda was to get rid of all the useless eaters, as they call them, those who refer an inferior stock. That was the reason, not because they cared about the rights of a woman. They couldn't care less about one person here and there with their own very real dilemma. They couldn't care less. But once you get the idea that life ain't so special after all for humans, and the public accept it, you can then go on a roll with it. And they have. Because now the graft of the elderly is now euthanasia. Clinics in different countries, and I'll be here shortly too. Because after all, under the United Nations, they say that their own definition of a good world citizen is a good producer and consumer. Producer and consumer. If you're just consuming in a pensioner, you're no longer a producer. You're a burden on society, on the economic system. That's all money that could go to government to squander on some other things, you see. That's the reality of the world. But emotions are used to the highest degree because they've worked for centuries on different peoples. It's emotions they whip up when they want to divide between Catholic and Protestant, or between Muslim and Christian or Jewish. Emotion, emotion, emotion. And they know exactly how to stir the pot and get it going. Male and female, same thing. They can even split males down, half this and half that. Females the same way. It's no different. It's a science, perfect science. Because people will always pick this or that. They're always given two choices, this or that. And they're guaranteed to pull half into one side and half into another. That's what voting's all about. It's a con. And it's emotive-based emotion, not logic, nor history, nor memory even is used. And no one thinks of the ulterior agenda because they're too lazy to go in to find it. So this article here says that it's okay to have abortion sites as long as it's for abortion, but not against abortion. And you can put anything up in the guise of art. We'll have corpses hanging on wires, for God's sake. Shown around the world now. Corpses plasticized and hanging on wires is art. Again, the dehumanization process that we accept. And it's there for reasons that you don't even know about. This is back in January of this year, the same article. The ACMA wrote back to a complainant, ACMA is satisfied that the internet content is hosted outside Australia and that the content is prohibited or potentially prohibited in its content. The Internet Industry Association, you see they're all sprung up, all these things that were ready to go, has a code of practice for internet service providers, which among other things sets out arrangements for dealing with such content. In accordance with the code, ACMA has notified the above content to make the makers of, I think it's 2A, approved filters for their attention and appropriate action. The code requires the ISPs to make available to customers a 2A approved filter. Despite this, the link continued to be published by popular news sites such as Whirlpool. In March, the ACMA upped the ante by sending to Whirlpool's ISP, Bulletproof Networks, an interim link deletion warning, warning them that they were in breach of the law and that failure to block access to the link in question could cost them $11,000 per day. Boy, did they want them bad, eh? Anything that's against the communistic system is going to be, they're going to use economics against you, massive economics. And believe you me, they will, because you see, the big international bankers set up and funded and trained the top communists of their day. Read your histories. Bulletproof pulled the link. This sequence of events was then reported by Electronic Frontiers Australia, and this is EFA, who described themselves as a non-profit national organization representing internet users concerned with online freedoms and rights. In a report that included the now infamous link, they wrote, "This demonstrates not only that the blacklist targets a wider range of material than child abuse, where the minister's rhetoric has been focused." That's how they brought it in. They always use paedophilia and stuff, you see. You see, always, always, always. It says, but also that the lines between art, obscenity, and political speech are not as bright and clear as politicians would have us imagine. Viewing or possession of RC content is not in itself illegal unless the content falls afoul of some other statute, such as those governing child abuse material. They added, despite the minister's ridiculous assertions that he means well, and we should take it on faith that the filter will be effective and benign, this latest episode demonstrates how serious run-ins with the censors can be, and that it does not only happen. I'm Alan Watts, and we're cutting through the matrix. This showing you that there's always another motive behind pretty well everything out there, especially when it comes to political correctness. There's always an agenda behind it, the same agenda I say, dehumanize society. We've already been debased by the cultural industry very quickly from songs they sang in the 50s, and it just plummeted, like Prometheus coming down, until literally we have just gibberish put out as music. It's all debased stuff that's, if you make out any words at all, it's all very, very primitive, linguistically minimal, and debased. That was by intent, as they dehumanize all of society and get the public to accept it. That's the main thing. We're the only species that has to be convinced, because we must acquiesce to our sentences that they give us. Getting back again to what I said earlier about Mr. Rockefeller saying that this generation was the cannon fodder for this massive upheaval that would be akin to the clearing of the land into the cities for the industrial era. Here's a typical article here. This is from USA Today, from I think a couple of days ago, a day ago. It says, economic casualties pile into tent cities. This is from Pinellas County, Florida. It says, Jim Marshall recalls everything about that beautiful fall day. The temperature was about 70 degrees. November the 19th, the sky was totally blue, and the laughter from a martini bar drifted into St. Petersburg Park, where Marshall 39 sat contemplating his first day off homelessness. And he goes on and on as to what happens when you're made homeless, and he tells you what it's like. But it says, for the economic homeless, now by the way, it says here that this, in this place alone, Pinellas or Pinellas County, Florida, it says there's 7,500 homeless people and 1,300 children in homeless families since this fantastic depression that was pulled off when we were looted on cue by the banks. It says here, for the economic homeless, the American ideal that education and hard work lead to a comfortable middle-class life has slipped out of reach. They're packing into motels, parking lots, and tent cities, alternately distressed and hopeful, searching for work and praying their fortunes will change. A typical statement here is, my parents always taught me to work hard in school, graduate high school, go to college, get a degree, and you'll do fine. You'll do better than your parents' generation. Marshall says, I did all those things for a while. I did have that good life, but nowadays that's not the reality. Tent cities and shelters from California to Massachusetts report growing demand from the newly homeless. The National Alliance to End Homelessness predicted in January that the recession would force 1.5 million more people into homelessness over the next 2 years. Already tens of thousands have lost their jobs, Alliance President Nan Roman says. The $1.5 billion in new federal stimulus funds for homelessness prevention will help people pay rents, utility bills, moving costs, or security deposits, she said, but it won't be enough. We're hearing from shelter providers that the shelters are overflowing, filled to capacity, says Ellen Basuk, president of the National Center on Family Homelessness. The number of families on the streets has dramatically increased. Pinellas hopes the tent city run by the Catholic Charities here since December 2007 has been largely for the chronically homeless, some of whom suffer from mental illness or struggle with drugs or alcohol. 20% of its 240 residents became homeless recently because of the economic turndown, says Frank Murphy, president of the Catholic Charities Diocese of St. Petersburg. We're seeing a change in the population. We're seeing a lot more that are just plain losing their jobs and their homes, says Sheila Lopez, chief operating officer of the charity. A lot are either job ready or working, but have lost their home because they were laid off, or their apartment. And now they can't go to work because they're not shaven, they're not clean, they're living in a car, or they're living on the street. The charity plans to expand the tent city and build an encampment in a neighboring county, an idea that has drawn objections from nearby homeowners and businesses. And that's your standard thing. That's your standard problem. In every country, it's the same thing. Those who still have are just ticked off that their value, their property is going to fall because you've got these tents living next door. And how New York used to deal with that is to bring in the bulldozers and bulldoze them down. And when Mel Lastman was the mayor of New York, of Toronto. He got the idea from New York, and he did the same thing with a Toronto tent city. That's how they get rid of the homeless, you see, to make them move somewhere else. That's the standard thing. It says here in Massachusetts, a record number of homeless families need emergency shelter, says Robin Frost, executive director of Massachusetts Coalition for the Homeless. In mid-April, there were 2,763 families in shelters, including 655 in motels, because the shelters were full. That's an increase of 36% since July, she says. There have been a high number of foreclosure properties, and many of them are multi-family apartments, Frost says. We're seeing a great number of families being displaced. The homeless include a startling number of first-time homelessness, she said. We asked them what industries they were involved in, and the majority were talking about construction, the housing industry, real estate. There was a direct correlation in the housing market crash. In Santa Barbara, California, 84 men and women sleep in their cars, trucks, or recreational vehicles in 17 parking lots around the city, says Jason Johnson with the New Beginnings Counseling Center, which runs the RV Safe Parking Program. The city, which allows the use of three municipal lots at night, supports the program, says City Parking Superintendent Victor Garza. Last May, there were 58 participants and no waiting list. Now 40 people are waiting. Then he goes on and on about other places, etc., who are all getting the same problem. This is what Rockefeller said. The upheaval. He said you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. These people are the broken eggs. And it's going to get worse, by the way. I also said, too, in 2001, I think it was that very night on a radio station, I said, UNIC implemented, on September the 11th, I said, UNIC implemented everything you see in a war situation, in a world war situation. I said, you'll see security, ID cards, eventually ration cards. I said, you'll eventually see people being, they want people on the roads. They want to see refugees on the roads. Everything you get in a war scenario has to be done across the world, but mainly in the so-called first world countries to bring them down. And they know from formula, from previous times, as I say, as those who are on the road will be ignored by those who still live in the buildings. That's standard, that's traditional. And you'll have an outer class that don't belong anymore. And then will come economic solutions to it. And we're already getting that. Well, there's just too many people. What they mean is, you see, there's too many people for a post-industrial era. They've taken the industry out of our countries by design. And most people who are now homeless and the ones who still got their homes didn't even know it was happening. They sailed right through, like they sailed through everything without observing anything. When the GATT treaties were signed, when years and years of negotiations and building up of China, training thousands and thousands and thousands of engineers, Canada was doing it since the 60s, communist China. And I said, why is Canada churning out all these engineers that go back to China? Because they don't have the factories. Well, it's because with GATT and that, they gave them the factories. They all came from the U.S. and Canada. That's where the factories came from, and Europe. Long-term strategy, long-term planning, and no one asked the obvious questions. Why are you training thousands of engineers to go back to a country where there's no factories? No one thinks. And everyone saw stuff suddenly appear in the shelves made in China. Going through the Marxist doctrine, the Soviet doctrine, they wanted one factory that would make toothbrushes for the whole of the Soviet Union. They got it. One factory to make the shoes for them all. They got it. That was called efficiency to them. That's what's happening today with us. Because the CFR talked about setting up China in the 1930s to be the manufacturer of the planet. Generation after generation just lived through their part of the script and are oblivious to what's going on. They're managed. We're being managed by experts. We're brainwashed with education system that now is run by UNESCO. to make sure everyone in every country gets the same brainwashing. We're put into the same Plato's cave so we can meet people from across the country, across the world. And we all talk about the same cave because that's all we've been taught. We're brainwashed. Simple. So were our parents. Now, I've mentioned how the computer is the big, big stick, because they said without the computer they couldn't pull any of this off, this IDing thing, this eternal surveillance, total information network. And I keep saying to people, you've all signed it into law. What do you think total means? It means all conversations, all faxes, all everything is kept forever, ever. Total information, not partial. That means you who are listening out here, out there. Everybody. IBM, which is a nice little code for I beam, you see, the I from Horus, the beam of the light from Horus or Ra. It's interesting too, it's also, they used that little symbology in the Space Odyssey 2001 for the code name for the computer HAL. If you just go one letter before, you have HAL, which is IBM. And IBM, of course, made big, big progress. They were always into categorizing and statistics, etc. And they made the first Kardex systems that were used. They used them in the concentration camps of Germany, and I'm pretty sure they also had a hand in the Soviet gulags as well. And here's a PR blurb about them from BBC News. All you get from the BBC News is propaganda. And they start off with, from Spitfires to Censors. Now, the Spitfire was an aircraft fighter they used in World War II. It got a bigger name than it deserved because it didn't win the Battle of Britain. The Hurricane really did. Anyway, and reality doesn't matter. It's by Darren Waters, technology editor. It's a software that underpins billions of financial transactions made every day. It's being developed at an IBM lab in a quiet part of Hampshire. Personally, House has been part of IBM's history for 40 years. But its role in technology development stretches back even further. Walking around the grand surroundings of Hursley House through the beautifully restored rooms of the mansion and the more aesthetic corridors and spaces of adjoining labs, all you can hear is a quiet hum of desktop computers. 66 years ago, and the noise from the main house and grounds would have been from the roar of Rolls-Royce engines attached to the arguably the most famous fighter of all the Spitfire. During World War II, Hursley House was the base of operations for Vickers. Now, Vickers was owned by Lord Vickers. Lord Vickers obtained a mass of his wealth. He already had done it, the Vickers family, in the opium trade, when they were dumping bales of it into China, along with all the guys, too, in the Skull and Bone Society at Yale. And during World War I, Vickers amassed a fortune, because he went into partnership with the inventor, Maxim, of the machine gun, the heavier machine gun. It was mounted on a tripod, and it was a water-cooled jacket and all that stuff. And so what they did, because they knew there was a war coming, you see, the Vickers would supply all the British and American troops with his model, and they would slightly alter it a little bit for the jacket for the German model. And they based their headquarters in Switzerland, and they amassed millions of dollars. That was the lovely Lord Vickers. And have been in the war industry ever since, as all of these big boys are, IBM too. And it says here, Vickers, the manufacturer of the iconic plane that helped turn the Battle of Britain in the UK's favour. For the last five decades, the house and grounds have been owned by IBM and have been devoted to research and developments. Over five decades, the work that goes on at Hursley for IBM has reflected the broader transformation of Big Blue itself from hardware company to software and services firm. Once IBM was at the forefront of computer development, these days IBM is more likely to be helping to drive cutting-edge software solutions and focuses primarily on developments. But then you have to scan down to see what they're up to, what really it is, get through all the PR and so on. It says it's now at the center of two key technology developments, transaction processing and pervasive messaging. Every time you use an ATM, book a holiday flight, or a flight, you're probably using CICS software that was developed here, he simply explained. Tied inextricably to CICS is IBM's pervasive messaging middleware called MQTT that guarantees delivery of data from point A to point B. We live in a world where intermittent outages in technology or web access are common, but in the global finance sphere, such things are unacceptable. Testing applications for pervasive messaging happens in the Emerging Technologies Lab, a small set of rooms that houses and demonstrations which at first glance would appear to be more at home at a school science fair. But it goes on to tell you what more, what they're really into. And it's this completely, where they're bringing everything together. It's they're bringing buildings together with chips, etc. It will also interface with this system that was mentioned in Ireland a few months ago, and I read it on the air, where you'll wear a thing on your head, and you'll be able to basically know where you're going and what's in that building, what it sells, and all the rest of it. Total integrated networking system. But it's also obviously to do with the final thing. The product is going to be a brain chip, and I think everyone knows it. But remember their history. Remember IBM's history. Because it made most of its money from basically identifying individuals and keeping records on individuals. That's for the military complex, for military purposes. Never forget it. What a world, and most folk haven't a clue of what's really going on. Now, we'll go to the phones now, and we've got Jason from Ontario. Are you there, Jason?
Hi there, Jason.
What? Yes.
Hi there. I just wanted to make a couple comments to you there. I want to bring this up with the New World Order and what their objectives are and maybe why they're the way that they are.
Hold on, and we'll go into it, and we'll hear what you have to say after this break. Back in a few moments. I'm Alan Watts, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix, on the line with Jason from Ontario, who is going to give us a few pointers, perhaps, on how we see things.
Yeah, I just want to expand on that a bit. Sorry, I got cut off. But for the War of Humanity upon itself, I just want to refer to... are you familiar with Roger Sperry and his research he's done on the left and right side of the brain?
I've seen a lot more than him. I've seen the old stuff, too. This is old, old stuff, yeah.
Yeah. I'm just looking at how it's kind of a left brain, right brain type of conflict that causes this. You have... what they're implementing now in the New World Order would attribute itself to the left side of the brain as being, sequential, mm-hmm. Directed, very linear in its motives.
Yeah, yeah. To them, it really seems quite practical and quite logical. That was the whole idea of the Star Trek, Mr. Spock. He always picked logic. Now, he was a Vulcan. Of course, that's fire again.
Yep.
And these characters belong to these ancient societies that know this kind of stuff. They believe that pure reason should rule the world and overrule human emotion or values. Yeah.
And it sort of kind of ties into your thing you mentioned earlier about how they admire fetuses as art and the anatomy in
yes.
plastic.
Yeah.
They see that as an art form, whereas a right-brained person who sees beauty in an artist... would see that, not the same way.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It is. You see, you must remember, too, these characters brought in what they called the Age of Reason. And they wrote screeds and screeds of stuff about how reason would rule. And the reason that they claimed the world is always in a mess is because people's emotions ruled their lives for them. Well, you see, we are complete human beings with emotion. If we don't have emotion, we're not a complete human being. We are a robot, basically. We're robots. And these characters at the top, being psychopaths, of course, always look to the practical solution to them. It's through their agenda, not humanity's agenda. And if they see themselves as farmers, and if we're superfluous in a certain era, Well, you just cull off the excess herd. That's what you do if you're a farmer. And that literally is what they want to bring in. They want to reduce the world's population down to 500 million people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I've stated it over and over. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I you know, you have Hitler, who is a great admirer of art. You have all these dictators that have collections that are you know, very vast. You know, so
Gorbachev had a portrait done of himself. It's in his home, and I put a photograph up one day on it.
Mm-hmm.
Where he has three photographs of him. One is him as a Jesus child with his mark on his forehead. It's in his living room.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is him as basically the new Jesus, the new Messiah for the greening system, yeah, the world greening system. These guys literally are petty megalomaniacs, but they belong to a very big, big, powerful club.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that was basically my point that I wanted to bring up.
Yes,
with you.
You're quite right, though. It's been a very old, ancient system, a battle. And in early times, even the early Christian symbols would show Jesus ascending on the cross with the serpent wrapped around him. If it was just him himself, it'd be emotion. The serpent was wisdom, logic. So the two were combined, and that meant perfection. That was the early mystic symbol of it. If you just have pure the serpent, you have coals and an emotional reason. And
yeah.
That's hell on earth.
You do see it through history here. You do?
Yes.
Okay.
But thanks for calling in.
No,
yeah, this goes back a way long time. But anyway, it's from a very wet Ontario, Canada. It's good night from Hamish and myself. And may your God or your gods go with you.
Mm-hmm.